Good evening. Welcome everyone to the Simple Actions group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is BJ and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, BJ.
For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
The Simple Actions group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing Step 12, Part B. Please welcome our panel this evening. We have Amy and Bill. Alrighty, I will read the first paragraph, which is going to be on page 96 in this case, and then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. Step 12 is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So page 96. Suppose now you are making your second visit to a man. He has read this volume and says he is prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. Let him know you are available if he wishes to make a decision and tell his story, but do not insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. Tonight we're going to start with Amy.
My name is Amy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Amy.
My sobriety date is May 9th, 1994, and my home group is Simple Actions. I would not say that I am great with newcomers. I don't have that maternal, nurturing, kind of earth mothery, you know, come lay up on me and tell me your problems. I'd really think about this as a life or death thing. I didn't think this up. One of my fellows probably in this room thought it up, but I will meet somebody at the level of their own willingness. So if somebody wants to meet me at a meeting, if somebody wants to read the book together, I am always available for that. Where it has gone wrong at this point for me in the past is people who want a friend, people who are lonely, people who feel like they need to be heard. And there's nothing wrong with those people. It's just I am not uniquely qualified to help them. I'm really not even inclined to help them. I would not say I'm overly sympathetic either. But anyone at all who does not want to die from alcoholism, I will give them everything I've got. Because I am 50 years old and have spent almost my entire adult life sober and basically free because of what has been given to me. So although I am not the most patient or tolerant person, there were people who put up with me and they met me at the level of my willingness. They were not looking to placate me. They were not looking to make friends with me. They were not looking to be the repository of all of my angst. And I'm so grateful because I love talking about me. And I would have bended ears about all of my problems and all the horrible things that had happened to me and all the circumstances. I had a sponsor one time who had me start doing a step 10 immediately. And she asked me to call her 3 times a day and, you know, just kind of fill her in what was going on. And I'm a very analytical person, and so I loved it. I loved going through 3 times a day, the psychology of me. And after about a week of it, she said to me, okay, I see that you've got the self-analysis part, but from now on, when you tell me what's going on in the day, leave out what anyone else did or said. And I just thought, well, she's an idiot because there's no story without that. And I just said, well, you know, you're not going to understand why I did what I did and why I said what I said if I don't tell you what everybody else is doing. And she said to me, no, you're the one that's not understanding here. And she was right. And thank God, because X number of years later, I'd still be singing the blues and telling you how hard my life is and, you know, my mom's driving me crazy and my job is hard and blah, blah, blah. So on this second visit, I will listen and listen and listen. But if and it's easy to tell. And the big book is very, very clear that somebody could be dying and I need to move on. Once it becomes obvious to me that someone is not ready to give up for good and all, I need to move on. So that's what's going on for me in this second conversation is I'm looking for that. I mean, also because I'm selfish and I don't want to screw around too much if the real deal isn't coming. That's all.
Thank you.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bill. My sobriety date is May 13, 1984. And my home group is the Bayview Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. David always says that I'm a softie for the newcomer, because I always have a trail of newcomers following me around the place. And I do. I do listen to them. I try and talk to them. I try and let them know that I'm there if they want it. But I'm not going to hold their hand and coddle them and baby them just like this. And he said, I don't have the time. If I'm wasting time doing that, I'm cheating somebody else that I'm working with a valuable time. It takes time. It just you have to be patient. I wasn't patient when I was drinking, that's for sure. You know, I hated people sitting in a bar telling about their problems, complaining about their problems. I'd say, Jesus, why don't you go to hell home? You know, what are you in here? I came here to drink and enjoy it. And then when I got to going to meetings and I was just about a year sober, my first sponsor said, I think you need to sponsor somebody. And I says, I don't think so. I says, I don't want to mess them up. He says, you can't mess them up any worse than you are. I said, well, thanks a lot. That doesn't make me feel happy. And I got my first sponsee. And over the years, you know, I do a lot of corrections work. I go into the 2 state penitentiaries out in Chesapeake. And I went into the Navy brig for 23 years, carrying meetings in there. Even though I never was locked up other than for maybe a couple hours, you know, for a DUI, I found something there I used to think when they were in jail and locked up and I, well, they're losers, you know, blah, blah, blah. That was my drinking attitude, you know. They look where they got. They deserve to be there. And then after I got there and I seen these guys and talked to them and got to understand them, got to know them, my mind and my attitude changed real quick. I sponsor 2 guys that have gotten out of correctional facilities. One's getting ready to celebrate 13 years. The other one's had about almost going on 6 years. And I'm taking on another challenge. I have a young man that his dad's in the program, and he's going to this thing called Commonwealth Challenge out in Virginia Beach. And so I'm going to mentor him for the next 18 months. And I know I got my hands full with this little turd. He's cocky as can be. He tried to give me an excuse for everything that's gone wrong in his life and who was responsible for it and everything. But I just finally sat him down and said, look, this is the way it's going to be. If you want me to help you, this is what we got to do. And I told him, I says, I will shoot you an email every day. I know you can't email back. You have to write a letter. At the end of the week, write me one letter. Just let me know how you're doing. And don't lie to me. Tell me the truth. If you're not enjoying the place out there, be honest about it. You know, don't lie about it. And he said, yes, he said, I'll do that. And I'm hoping he does do it, you know, because I sponsored another young fellow back in 98 that went through there, and he did fantastic. He was in and out of juvie hall. He was in and out of all kinds of problems. And, you know, today he's happily married. He went through the service. He got a couple medals when he was over in Iraq. He's doing good. And it's all because of the same principles I learned in AA, I practiced with him. I did the same things that were taught to me here in AA. And I always look forward to the newcomer. I always try and walk up to them and shake their hand and let them know that I recognize them. I see that they're a newcomer. Just let them know somebody cares. And that's a thing that when I first got here, I didn't see a lot of. You know, I didn't see a lot of that in some meetings. And then over the years, I've seen it grow and more, I see people walking up to the newcomer, shaking their hand, letting them know you're welcome. And the guys I sponsor, they come to my house every Sunday night. We do a big book study in my garage. In the summer, it's out on my patio. And when it's good weather, it's a cookout before a meeting, horseshoes or maybe volleyball game. My old bones are not up to all that stuff anymore, but they're up to it, and they like to do it. It gives them something else to do. It shows them that they can do something. You know, and they're just not going to meetings, that this is a fellowship. This is an organization that where people care about each other because we have the same common ground. I would be dead today if it was left up to me, because when I got here, all I wanted to do was just get sober for a year, and I was going to retire from the Navy at the time early and go on my way. And something happened. The year went and came, went and gone. 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you know. And it was all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't all because of anything I did. And people who were here, David knows some of them, Ray and Gladys, two people that didn't have a pot to pee in, pardon my French, or window to throw it out of. But they went out of their way to pick you up. Ray had a car that you could hear five blocks away. It made so much noise, but he would come and pick you up and take you to a meeting. You know, that's the way he was. John was another one. He used to always say, well, if you're not happy today, what day are you waiting for? And I used to say, God, I wish you'd shut up or get a new line. But after a while, I started to find myself saying that. If you're not happy today, what day are you waiting for? And my guys looked at me and said, oh, God, you're just like him now. And that's what happens. It rubs off on you when you get in here. So if you're new, just keep coming back. Be honest with yourself. Be honest with your sponsor. And just keep treading forward, you know. It's going to work. I mean, I don't care if you put 10% of the effort you did in the lying and drinking and all that into your recovery effort, you're going to get sober and stay sober. Simple as that. I've seen so many guys do it. And the word God chases you out, I hope alcohol chases you back in real quick. That's all I get for now.
Thank y'all. Next reading is on page 98. It is not the matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. That often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence upon God. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house.
I have definitely made a lot of errors confusing being of service to God and my fellows, and being of service so that I can feel good about myself because I know it's what I'm supposed to do. And the difference is that when I'm being of service so I can feel good about myself and I know it's what I'm supposed to do, it's usually a situation where other people have said, oh, I tried that, it didn't work out, that's really not, and what's happening inside of me is, well, they might have failed, but I can do it. That might have been too much for her, but I bet I can handle it. And every single time my ego has engaged around service, it's a big crash and burn. It's just no good. I am not always in a contemplative frame of mind, and I still have a tendency to fall easily into binary thinking. I mean, it's black or it's white. It's good or it's bad. And I'll look at something and my calculating mind will automatically say, this is a bad situation, I gotta get in here, I gotta do something about it. When the truth of the matter is, I don't know what kind of situation it is. It's a bad situation in the world according to Amy, and now I'm gonna throw some of my will on it and I'm probably gonna make it worse. What my higher power enables me to do one day at a time is to open my mind instead of either I sponsor 10 people and I deal with all of the newcomers and the messy situations, or I hold myself away from that because I just don't feel like being in the chaos anymore. What freedom for me in the moment is that my higher power allows me to hold the tension of opposites. No, I don't want to do this. Yes, I'm going to do this in spite of that. Yes, this looks very difficult, and I'm going to do it anyway. Instead of either this is an easy, simple path in front of me, or I'm just going to head in the opposite direction. It is beyond my human power to cut off that calculating monkey mind, that thing that is constantly judging, that makes me live, in preference as opposed to in presence. In preference, I would not answer the phone. My preference is I'm not going to answer the phone every time it rings because I'm reading a book. I don't want to be bothered. In presence, in the presence of God, in the present, in living in that moment, empowered by my higher power, I don't want to answer the telephone, but I do it anyway. And that's not the kind of doing it anyway because I know it'll be good for me. It's doing it anyway in spite of my absolute opposition. My mother is sick. She's quite sick. And as much as my mother wants my attention, that is exactly how much I do not want to give her my attention. I have this perverse thing that the more you jump up on me, the farther I'm going to get away from you. And what is happening is that I have lots of stuff that shows up on my nightly review, and I'm making lots more phone calls than I normally do. But in spite of myself, I am showing up for my mother. I am not mouthing off to my mother. I mean, it is loud inside my head around my mom, but I'm not letting it out of my mouth. And that is because I'm going to God, asking him to show me what is my next step to be. Because when I operate as if I know what the next step is to be, like who needs my help and exactly how they need my help, I always get myself into so much trouble. So, I mean, I've sponsored people who cried to me because I was harsh and judgmental and I thought I was being a marshmallow. I've had people leave rooms where I thought I was being kind of witty and amusing and people thought that I was being harsh and abrasive. So, you know, back to that seven-step prayer, I have to give God all of me, good and bad. I mean, I can't do much with the bad part of me. I can't seem to budget. And the good part of me, I really can't be trusted to move forward with that either. because I'm depositing too much self in that. And that really, that changes the way that I'm of service to others. I do not go out proselytizing anymore. I do not ask people anymore, do you have a sponsor? Do you need a sponsor? And I don't know if that's the right thing or the wrong thing. For right now, it's the right thing for me because I have a tendency to, you know, just do a shock and awe on people and mow people down, and it's just, it's no good. There's just too much self in it. So that's all.
Thanks. Yeah, when I came to AA, I looked at, you know, service work. I thought, I don't want to do that. You know, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. And I was offered to go in the Navy brig and bring service work in there, bring a meeting in there. And I said, well, I've never been locked up. And then my sponsor said, well, you were locked up that one time for DUI and you spent about 6 hours in jail, didn't you? I said, yeah, but it was only 6 hours. He says, well, I think you should do this. And I started going in there. And I said, I'm going to do it for 2 years. And then it just got to be the point where I just got enthused with it. I enjoyed doing it. And I was there for 23 years until it moved out to Chesapeake, all the way out on the North Carolina border. The guys I work with, and I talk to them about the higher power of God, I try not to make them think they have to have what I have. They can have whatever they want, whatever they choose. I had the privilege when I first came here, I was fighting with that thing because I was raised a Catholic and I didn't like it, and I'd gotten in trouble with a sweet little nun by the name of Mary Teresa. She hit me on the hand with a ruler one day and I told her, don't ever hit me again, you damn penguin. And Mary Teresa just looked at me and she said, get out of church, William, and don't come back till next week. I could have sworn she threw a few F-bombs in there. But a friend of mine told me years later, no, she didn't. And I said, you sure? I said, because that's why I never went back. And I got to meet Father Joseph Martin, and we were talking out in Bayside Hospital in 1986. And we were talking about AA, the higher power, God, spirituality, you know. And he says, you know, Bill, he says, spirituality is for those that have been to hell and don't want to go back. He says, so just keep that in mind, he says. And then he said to me, oh yeah, and there's good news and bad news. I thought, oh crap, just like my counselor in treatment said, the good news was there's a God, the bad news is you're not it. And I didn't like that. I thought that was, you know, wrong for him to say that to me, because I thought I was doing a pretty good job running my life. And he says, well, the good news is there's a God, and the bad news, I said, yeah, I know, I'm not it. He goes, no. I says, what is it then? He says, he's not Catholic. I said, Father, what are you saying? He says, he's not Catholic, he's not Baptist, he's not Lutheran, he's not Episcopalian. He says, he's all of them, but he's not one of them. And he explained about the spiritual side. And I realized that, you know, when I was saying my prayers, I would have a flow come over me, a calmness. I could be upset and mad about something, and in a matter of 10 to 15 minutes, it just seemed like it calmed down. It was soothing. I couldn't see, touch, or feel it, but it was there, you know? And I started to look at that, and I realized that's what it was. It was spirituality. It was coming into my life slowly but surely. And I tell the guys I sponsored not to worry about trying to have it right away, you know? Do like the step two in the 12 and 12, so took a piecemeal, a little bit at a time. Bite off as much as you can and go on. Because if I had thought that I had to have the God of the Catholic Church again, I would have been back out there drinking, unfortunately, because that's what I thought. I thought that's what they were talking about. I remember seeing it. They said, you're going to go to meetings and they're going to talk about God. And I said, oh, no. The guy said, why? I said, they're not going to make me sell these big books on the corners, are they? He said, no. I says, hey, shaving my head already? He said, no. I said, well, it's good. That's two good ones so far. But what it was I just wasn't, it wasn't that I didn't believe in God or trust God. I didn't think God believed in me anymore. I believed that God didn't like me, hated me, and was out to get me. Because every time something happened in my life, like my mother died as a little kid, he said, well, God took her. I was mad at God. Then another thing happened. Oh, God did that. And everything was God's fault. So it took some time to develop spirituality, you know, and I can find it so easy nowadays. I can walk down by the waterfront and just stand down there and watch the water, you know, watch the birds on the water, or walk in a park You know, I go out to Seashore State Park at least 2 times a week and walk around the trails out there, and I get a peace of mind and calmness over me. You know, tonight I could have got out of this. I wasn't feeling well. I told David, he said, well, you can bail out. I said, no, no, I have to do this because it's a commitment. You know, and I even told him, I said, if I have to get up to leave to go to the bathroom, there's a reason for it. But, you know, I have to be committed to Alcoholics Anonymous because the people at Alcoholics Anonymous were committed to me when I came here. You know, Ray, Gladys, John, those guys went out of their way to make sure that I got to meetings because I didn't have a vehicle at the time. They came over, picked me up, took me to meetings, and every night of the week they were at my door. One of them was at my door taking me to a meeting. First 90 days, I probably went to about 120 meetings. I wasn't really excited about it, but the more I stayed, the better my life was getting. And today, my life is fantastic. You know, I had a great job for 16 years. I ran the intergroup office, you know, working for AA. I gave that up a couple of years ago. I figured it's time for someone else to take that and do something with it. I still go out to the prisons. I go out to the Navy brig every once in a while. One of the guys I sponsor, he does meetings out there now. So I go out with him every once in a while. But I have to stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous to keep my spirituality. Because if I start to use the excuse like tonight, I had a stomach flu. Oh, I don't feel too good. I think I should go home, David. Then I go home, I'd sit on my butt watching Boobus Tubus, you know, and I got nothing out of it. By coming here tonight, I get something out of it. My battery gets recharged. I'm around people that I know. There's a lot of people in this room that I've known for years, you know, and that's a fantastic thing. When I was drinking, most of my friends were just short-term acquaintances, and here I have so many long-term acquaintances. That's all I got on that for now. Thank you.
Thank y'all. Next reading is also on page 98. Now the domestic problem. There may be divorce, separation, or just strained relations. When your prospect has made such reparation as he can to his family and has thoroughly explained to them the new principles by which he is living, he should proceed to put those principles into action at home. That is, if he is lucky enough to have a home. Though his family be at fault in many respects, he should not be concerned about that. He should concentrate on his own spiritual demonstration. Argument and fault-finding are to be avoided like the plague. In many homes, this is a difficult thing to do, but it must be done if any results are to be expected. If persisted in for a few months, the effect on a man's family is sure to be great. The most incompatible people discover they have a basis upon which they can meet. Little by little, the family may see their own defects and admit them. These can then be discussed in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness.
It has not been my experience that everybody else in the family got to these rooms or that things settled down a whole lot. I am one of 5 siblings and no one made it to recovery and stayed except for me. And my mom went to Al-Anon long enough to know the words to use to really nail me when something's going on about my alcoholism. She did not stay long enough for it to, well, maybe it did transform her, and I'm just not capable of picking it up. I don't know. But what I do know is that although the circumstances of my siblings' lives, my family's lives, are still chaotic and unmanageable, I am able to show up when I'm supposed to. And it's not because I'm great, it's because God's great. I don't want to show up. I did not want to take my niece in over the summer when my man was dying and it was her umpteenth time at trying to get sober. It was just the last thing I wanted to do. And I did anyway. I did not have the power to change my mind about that, but God did have the power. And I was not alone in it, because every time something happened, there was someone I could call. There were plenty of people that I could call to talk about what do you do when you've got a newly sober person in your home and things are already kind of difficult, and now there's an open flame, basically, on the third floor. With my mother, with my brothers, with my sisters. I have one sister who is, she's a quadriplegic. She fell down the stairs 2 years ago in a drunken rage. And she is still really, really mad that she cannot drink anymore. I have another sister who had a brain tumor a few years ago. When they removed the brain tumor, they removed the part of her brain that had her inhibitions in it. So she started drinking, she started running around town, she started showing her tail, really. And so now she is in a locked facility. My oldest brother has multiple sclerosis, and he has completely lost the ability to speak or walk. And my youngest brother lives in Hawaii, and he went out there for college. He never came back. He's lost in the dope fields. That's just the way it goes. And none of these circumstances are things that I would like. I would like to tell you that we stand around the piano at Christmas and play songs and sing, and everybody gets each other the right gift and, you know, whatever. But that's not... Nobody ever gets me the right gift. But anyway... I always exchange. That's not what I would want for myself at all. And I'm not even going to presume to say, but that must be what God wants me. What I will say is that I am extraordinarily grateful that out of a family of drunks, addicts, every kind of addiction you could think of, that I'm sitting here, that I'm upright, that I do not have any life-threatening disease other than alcoholism, and I'm 100% sure of the solution to that. I have made amends to every member of my family. Some people thought I was full of crap, and they just said, you know what, you've been lying since the day you were born. I don't want to hear this, you know, just go on and do whatever you're going to do. I've also had family members who, you know, hugged me and cried, and it was great for a month, and then things just kind of reverted to the way they are. So I get the opportunity to learn how to accept what previously would have been unacceptable. And I get the opportunity to be the person that, should anyone happen to want to reach out a hand, I'll be there to give them somebody else's phone number. That's all I have to say about that.
Thanks. My brother would call me every so often and say to me, are you still going to those meetings? I'd say, yeah, Ed, why? He says, man, you must be really, and he used a different word, I'd say messed up. He said, I didn't know you were that bad off. And I said, don't you think, you know, it's overboard, you're going overboard? I said, no, I don't think so. And we talked, and I said, well, look at you. Four marriages, you got at least five kids that we know of, you know. you've wrecked four or five cars, you know, and you've lost a lot of good jobs. You know, I'm doing something for myself. I wrecked a lot of relationships with my drinking, so I'm trying to change. And my father would do the same thing, call, and I stopped trying to tell him that they need to get sober. I just said, yeah, you're right, that's right, good, nice talking to you, goodbye. And the weird thing is, I don't know if the fact that I stayed sober got to them, but when my dad died, he had not had a drink in almost a year. My brother died in 2005 or 2006, and he hadn't drank in over a year and a half. I didn't notice. They had stopped calling me, you know, none of these midnight calls and that, telling me that they're having problems and that. And what I do with all the guys I sponsor is I tell them, if you've got domestic problems, you need to see a counselor. I'm not a marriage counselor. I said, if you take my advice, you're probably in worse condition than you are right now. I have a young man that he's going through a divorce. His wife came out of the clear blue and said, after 9 years, I don't think I want to be married anymore. I don't have any kids and I don't want to be married. And he called me up and he says, told me what was going on. I said, well, how you handle it? He says, I'm doing just like you said. He said, I called a lawyer. He says, I got a separation agreement going. He says, I told her she's got 2 weeks to make up her mind if she doesn't want to live with me, and she needs to get out of the house so I can put it on the market, get rid of it. They just bought a home just in the last year and a half. And he's handling it because of this program. You know, he's learned how to be a man and not go ballistic and scream out. Another one of my guys went through a rough spot in his marriage, and he was thinking maybe divorce was the only thing. And then I told him, I said, look, I'm not supposed to say this, but I just happen to know by some circumstance that your wife is going to Al-Anon. And she never went to Al-Anon before. She never seen him drink. She married him after he was sober. And he says, you sure? I said, I'm just telling you what I've been told. And he went back and approached her, and she told him, yes, she realized there was things that she wasn't doing for herself that could enhance the marriage, and she was working on that. Now, today, they're working and dealing with each other and getting along well. One of the guys I had is, he wasn't going to get back with his girlfriend. He told me, no, I can't. I said, you have to have a cordial relationship with her because she's the mother of your son. I said, if you want that kid to be in your life, you need to treat her right now. I said, you never need to call her a name, cuss her out, talk anything bad about her. I said, because if you do, it's going to come back to you. And that happened to me with a guy. His son said to him one day, he says, Daddy, how come you don't ever say anything bad about Mommy, but she calls you all kinds of dirty names? And he says, that's because she's your mother. You do what I told him to do. I said, you might have to bite the bullet. It might be untasteful. You won't care for it, but you got to do it sometimes. And he's doing it. This guy's doing it. Now, the girlfriend and him got married. and they have another girl, a child, a little boy. So, this program has an effect on people. And I like to share about one thing. In Bayview, years ago, we used to have these two ladies that came every week. And the only reason they came was to the step study was to learn about Alcoholics Anonymous, because her friend was dying from cirrhosis of the liver. And they wanted to be able to treat her with dignity and respect and kind of be able to talk about AA with her. And, you know, when she wanted to talk to them, they'd understand it better. And they came for like 6 months to 9 months. They stopped coming. They came back about 6 months later. One of them came back and says, you know, Margaret died. She passed away, but she died sober. And we're using your steps in our life. We just took the word alcoholic out. So this is definitely a God-given program. I truly believe God led me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous led me back to a God of my own understanding today. That's good.
Thank you. The fourth reading is on page 100. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances.
I'm sure this is in the 12 and 12, but it says that those who scoff at prayer have not done it enough. The prayer and meditation are both in that arena for me. I also am thinking about if we fail to enlarge our spiritual life, we will not be able to stay sober. I've said this before, there is always somebody who has a book to suggest. There is always a speaker who says, I read X and it changed my life. It just seems like this program meets me wherever I am. And if I am willing to enlarge my spiritual life, the next right thing turns up. At first, it was for me because I had been raised in an Episcopalian background. It had to be C.S. Lewis, Emmett Fox. It had to be Christian theologians for me, because I didn't want to go to hell if I was reading, you know, a hippie or something. But then as time went on, my mind opened, and I could take in other philosophies, other religions. There is no way to fail. God does all of the heavy lifting. I mean, there's this saying that, you know, if you don't want to get screwed, don't assume the position. I think to myself that if I want to meet God, I need to assume the position. And the position for me is enlarge your spiritual life. Sometimes enlarging my spiritual life means that I go places that I've never been before. Sometimes enlarging my spiritual life means that I make a phone call to someone that I've never called before. Sometimes it means that I go to Amazon.com and look up spirituality, and in that thing that says, if you like this book, you may like these books, I'll order those books. Whatever it is. Again, I am the smallest part of the equation. God is the big part of the equation. All I have to do is keep putting myself in a position for God to give me what he knows that I need. Because I don't even know what I need. I mean, I think I know what I need, but I really don't. I think that I need a life of ease and comfort. Apparently, but I need a life of chaos and unmanageability so that I will continue to desperately seek God. If I had been one of those people that got to AA and got separated from alcohol and everything just settled way down and I got married and had kids and took them to tennis lessons or whatever normal people do, maybe I would not be still desperately seeking God. But I am. And I'm grateful that I am, because that connection, that is the only thing that makes the day for me. In the world according to Amy, no one is doing what they're supposed to be doing. No one does it as well as they should. I realize as I'm saying this, I sound a lot like my mom. I went grocery shopping for her last week, and she had me go to a bunch of different grocery stores, a bunch of different pharmacies, because she had coupons. And to save 30 cents, I had to go a mile. Anyway, I'm the idiot that did it. But when I got back, she told me that I had purchased too much food for her. And I just stood there and looked at her and said, you know, it's never going to be right, is it? It's just never going to be right, is it, Mom? And I left the house. But I'm realizing now as I'm saying this, I have that too. You know, I don't want to have to keep forgiving the world for not being what I think it should be. But the fact is, that's what life is. And the fact is, I cannot hope to live out of resentment, which is, you know, just my self-centered fear that I'm not going to get what I think I need, or actually all of mine boil down to that you won't think I'm as great as I want you to think I am. I want you to think I'm exceptional all the time, and I'm deathly afraid that I'm really not exceptional at all. There's nothing special about me. So that kind of ickiness right there drives me a lot. And the only antidote to that is working with others. The only antidote to that is showing up in these meetings, telling the truth, sharing my review with others so they can tell me the things in myself that I don't see. Somebody before the meeting was talking about writing out the sick man prayer. I am probably one of the some are sicker than others. I write a resentment inventory out at least 3 times a week. My nightly review does not just end with a this, and then at the end I get to say, what have I put in the stream of life? I got to do a full-blown resentment inventory. Get through all those 4 columns. It does not release for me without doing the work. But thank God there is the work, because I would walk around with my head on fire all of the time. And my life, instead of forgiving you for not being what I think you should be, I would be asking you to forgive me because of how often I mouth off and how often I am attempting to massage and manipulate circumstances to suit me instead of allowing God to change me to fit in with what is. I had a wonderful spiritual mentor at one point in my recovery, and he used to say to me all the time, get up and know that you do not know. And that just, I mean, I can't stand to say I don't know. I mean, I say it, but I really don't like it. You know, I'll say, I'll find out. You know, I'll go look it up. I'll go to the library. I'm great at research. But I don't like to just say, I don't know, I have no idea. Or I don't have any experience with that, I can't help you. Because I really will morph into a marriage therapist and a financial counselor and a medical doctor and everything else. Because I really do think I'm smarter than all those people. And I can probably give you just as good advice as they can. But that would not be the truth. And I'm sure that I'm engendering resentments around me all the time because of it. I've lost my train of thought. Go ahead. Lost.
I can agree on a lot that Amy said. For me, when I came here, I had a lot of anger, I had a lot of resentments, and I couldn't figure out why they weren't going away. And it was told to me that, you know, if I didn't enhance my spiritual development, that they were going to stay there, and I was eventually going to get drunk. And today, when I look, when I feel uncomfortable, I feel that icky feeling inside. I know there's something wrong, and I know usually it's with me. It's not with you. If I get upset with somebody, it's not with them, it's with me. Sometimes it's because they do a behavior that I used to do and I don't like about myself, so I get upset with them, or just that their behavior I feel is unacceptable and I'm trying to play God. So I have to stop and think. When I start getting those feelings, I have to stop and think and ask myself, you know, am I trying to grow in this program spiritually, or am I trying to slide backwards? Because I see a lot of people, I've seen people with more time than I have gone back out, you know, because they stopped developing their spiritual growth. You know, they just felt they had it. They had arrived. I remember a guy saying that to me, he had like 29 years. He says, well, next year I'll have 30 and I will have arrived. I said, I don't think so. And sure enough, when he got 30 years, he took drink. He went out there and got a couple car accidents, got himself two or three DUIs, and you know, put everything back out. He's back in the program now, struggling like crazy because he's still trying to think that, well, I did it for 30 years, I can do it. You know, I don't need to have that new sponsor tell me to do this, do this. Like, I'm not a kid anymore, and he doesn't want to adhere to the program. And all I can do for him when he calls me is to say, you know, just get on your knees and say a simple little prayer. Just God help me. God help me. And that works. And in the morning, I ask God to help me. In the evening, I say thank you. My prayers are simple. They're not all those great, like it talks about the, like a prayer for Santa Claus, make a list for Santa Claus. Oh, I'd have all this. Oh, God, you got to make this person well. You got to get this person hit the lottery. You got to do this. You got to do that. And I say, and I said, yeah, I've been praying, asking God to help me win the lottery, and it hasn't happened. And the guy said, well, you need to buy a ticket, which I hadn't bought. So, you know, I was just figuring he was going to give it to me anyway. I have to be willing, to get on my knees and just ask for help. I have to humble myself. And that was a hard thing for me to do, especially when I was in the military and on a ship at night to get down on my knees in front of my rack, you know, in the chief's quarters. You know, I had a young chief come up to me one day, he thought I fell. He said, can I help you up here, chief? I said, no, that's okay, I'm all right. I'm just saying my prayers. And a couple days later, I noticed when I was saying my prayers, he was saying his prayers. And he came up to me later, he says, I figured if you could say your prayers, I could say. He says, I say my prayers every night with my kids. And he's not in a fellowship. He says, I say it all every night, but I wouldn't do it here because I was afraid of being mocked. You know, and that's what I was afraid of when I first came here. So for me, if I don't stay spiritually fit, you know, I will drink again. I know that for a fact. It's just one of those things that happens. It happens too many times to too many people. They stop going to meetings. They stop calling a sponsor. They stop working the steps. They stopped enlarging their spiritual growth. And all of a sudden, they took suddenly drunk. And all of a sudden, it's like, well, it was this one's fault or that one's fault. It's nobody's fault but mine if I take drunk. It's my fault because I am planning it by not doing the things I'm supposed to do that I'm taught to do. And I'm supposed to do it every day and continue doing them. So that's what I got on that.
Thank y'all. We have a couple minutes left, so I'll read the final paragraph, and then if you guys could take a minute to wrap up. Page 100.
You did good.
Assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we go to their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. His only chance for sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland ice cap, and even there, an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Ask any woman who has sent her husband to distant places on the theory he would escape the alcohol problem.
I am recovered from the alcohol problem. It is not, the promise came true that it would just be gone. We wouldn't have to work for it. It just is gone. I've heard people talk about wanting a beer on a hot day. It would be good. I just don't think that way. It's not, I mean, I don't have much reason to go into bars, but I don't have a problem going. I probably don't belong in a bakery, to tell you the truth, but bars, it's not that big of a deal. I notice that I don't want to be around people who are impaired. It's just not fun. But it's not an issue. And it's not an issue because I am not the person that I was. And I did not change myself. God changed me. And while I was busy working the steps and paying attention to what the directions in the big book were, God was doing something deep down in here. It wasn't like I noticed that it was gone. It was kind of a thing that I'm in a situation and I think, oh, I couldn't care less about that anymore. It just happens. And my experience is that that's how everything works out. Whatever emotional pain, resentment, self-centered fear, whatever kind of mess I've gotten myself into, if I apply these directions, something miraculous always happens. While I'm busy writing out those four columns, the God of my understanding is deep down inside of me changing stuff around. And I really have very little to do with it. I'm not running that show at all. It just is happening. And I have such an inquiring mind. It is really a gift that there are these precise directions in the big book on how to work the steps, on how to live, on how to get along with others, on how to just be on my way rejoicing. Whatever it is, the directions are there. And while I'm following those directions, instead of making up directions, because I was always the kid that, you know, when they say, don't turn over your test and start until you've read, I never read the directions. Never. And it never did happen to me that I had done the whole thing wrong. But I have heard of other people who, they did end up doing the whole thing wrong because they didn't follow directions. But I've never followed directions. I still don't follow directions. If I get a new whatever, if I cannot just look at the thing and figure out how to put it together, I'm done with it. I'm not messing with that. I'll find somebody else to put it together for me. I don't want to follow the directions, and I have a tendency to kind of just quickly go through them and say, well, 1, 2, and 3 don't apply to me. I'm going to do 4 and 5. I'm going to put 6, 7, and 8 together. I'm done. I'm on to the next episode of my life. That's how I naturally think. But the only place that I did not do that at all is following the directions of the big book. And while my inquiring mind has been occupied following these exact specific directions, God has been changing me to a person who is not angry all the time, mouthing off all the time, just looking for ease and comfort all the time. I am a dignified woman. I was going to say lady, but that's probably not right. I'm a grown up. I am a grown up woman, and I have responsibilities and obligations, and I honor those things. And sometimes I kick and scream on the phone with somebody about doing it, but I do it. I show up. I do it. This whole thing that we're about here is so easy when the directions are followed. That's all that has to be done. Thanks.
When I got here, it wasn't too long before, probably about 9 months, 8 to 9 months, I realized that the obsession to drink was gone. And I think what it was boiled down to, we don't see a lot of them anymore, was 12-step calls. You know, I went on a 12-step call with old Ray out on in the Bay Oaks trees, where the trees are, at the park they're making down there. There was a young kid behind his cottage, drunk on his butt, laying in the rain, soaking wet, and he was getting ready to go in DTs. And I watched Ray give him a Cairo cocktail, Cairo syrup and orange juice. And I watched him come around slowly. And when the ambulance got there, they said, what'd you do? And Ray told him exactly. The guy said, great. And he says, thank you. And they took him away. He came back to the meetings. He started coming to meetings. He'd go to Little Door on a regular basis. He got sober. He left the area. He came back a couple times. He was still sober. I don't know if he's still sober today. But I think the best or funniest one I've ever had was with Bob H. Bob H. and I went to a 12-step call, 1 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning. This guy only wanted to go to Shoney's or IHOP. He wanted to go to a restaurant. He wanted somebody to take him out for breakfast. We found out later on he'd been calling the 12-step line every night, and the people had been falling for his scam and taking him out. And then he'd get his meal, eat, and then he'd say, nope, never mind, I don't need this stuff, and go back home. So he was there. We got to the house, and he says, who the hell are you? Pardon my French. And Bob says, I'm Bob, and he's Bill. He says, oh, how quaint, just like the original, too. And we just looked at each other and knew that it was not going to be a real good 12-step call. And finally, he just got tired of hearing us talk about AA, and he told us to get out of the house. And he says, I don't need you here. Get out. And he's here. He is sleeping on the floor in the living room on a mattress because his father's house is getting sold. His brothers let him stay there so he wouldn't be on the streets. And he's complaining, you know. So he told us that he was going to call GSO and have us kicked out of AA, have our cards revoked, and that we messed up a good 12-step call. And I looked at Bob, and Bob looked at me, and Bob says, I don't think so. The guy says, how can you say that? Bob says, we're still sober. And the guy said a few expletives that I can't say here either, and that was it. So I truly believe that this program saved my life. It's given me a new outlook on life. It's given me people in my life that are wonderful, fantastic. David's been a great friend of mine for years, and whenever he asks me for something, I always do it. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Let's have a hand for our awesome panel. Thank you guys so much. We'll now pass the seventh tradition basket. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, which is to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any AA-related announcements?
Good evening. My name is Bridget. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome everybody to an eating meeting next week, April 6th, Joys of Recovery in Chesapeake, Thursday night, celebrating the 8th anniversary. Please come. Join us. We'll have a speaker and dinner. Dinner, fried chicken at 7, speaker at 8. There'll be a paper on the table.
Thank you. Any other announcements?
Yeah, the Bayview group of Alcoholics Anonymous will have its anniversary on June 17th. Unfortunately, it's the day they picked for Gratitude in Action. We found that out after we already gotten the date from the church. But it'll start at 5:30 in the evening. We'll have three speakers, an AA speaker, an Al-Anon speaker, and an Alateen speaker. The disease is a family disease, and it's really moving when you hear one of those young kids up there and sharing their story about how they're, and especially with the father right in the room, sharing about how the kid was fearful of his father and feared that he would never live to be 12 or 13. So it's powerful. And it is our 34th and a half. That's right. because we're a half you-know-what group. Try to be nice.
Thank you. I have an announcement. We're having Evan C. from Charlotte speak here next Monday, April 3rd. We have supper and a speaker. Potluck at 6. Please bring a dish if you're able. And at 7 p.m., Evan C. will be speaking.
She doesn't say yes.
Thanks. Simple actions, yes. Oh. Yes, sir.
Can I add something to that?
Oh, sure, please.
They're yellow flyers, right?
Yes, yellow.
So home group members and any members, anybody in the room, let's take all of the yellow flyers out of here tonight. They're not going to do anything in that back room. Let's take them all out of here and get them out into the community. Please come back to the ditch next week. We're going to have a party in this room right here.
Alrighty. Simple actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hands. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you.
Christine.
Hey, welcome. Glad to have you. Anybody else?
Thanks, all. You were terrific tonight.
You were too. Thank you.
Hey, welcome.
Welcome.
Anybody else? Hey, awesome. We have literature available over here. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting if you'd like to purchase a book. Sponsorship question. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come talk to me. Reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting, audio recordings, and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. In closing, can we thank our panel one more time? Thanks for all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the stuff discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be at Plaza del Sol down the road on off of Colonial just before the train tracks. It's a Mexican restaurant. Could I have a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164?
Aaliyah. My name's Aaliyah, alcoholic.
Hi, Aaliyah.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellow. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you.
Thanks for reading. Let's close with the Lord's Prayer.
Temptation, but deliver us from evil.